Okay, welcome everyone for the English medium discussion. And last week we fairly covered the Puraveda Sutta. We had to start a new one. So before going to the new topic, I would like to invite if there are any other topic suggestions or interview reports as the starting point.
Pasarai Bante.
Oh.
Bhante, we have received one general report and three reports from Rukhantan Satipasala.
Yeah.
With your permission, I would like to present.
Yes.
Yes, first report, Bhante. Dear Bhante, I'm 17 years old and this is my experience. Please advise me. Recently, I had a function called formal where everyone gets to dress up and dance. Whilst I was preparing for the function, I recognized my innate attachment to my looks and my clothes. I was consumed with this unbending desire to have everything be perfect, that even the slightest imperfections made me mad. Throughout this experience, I realized that my desire only made me dissatisfied with everything, thus preventing me from enjoying the actual event. However, whilst I have learned this, I still can't let go of my desire to be perfect when it comes to clothes and appearances. Therwan Saranai. End of the report, Bhante.
So for the 17 years old, this is a very important, heavy thing, because you are recognizing and world is recognizing you. So whenever you are socializing, you are in trouble. You are never perfect. But you are alone yourself, there are no backdrop against which you have to compare. So yeah, you feel like lost. When you are in the society, you are inferior. Your cosmetics and gloss over part is not efficient, not sufficient. So that is how we are making a paradox. When we are alone, we are completely lost. There is no backdrop. Against the backdrop, that means against the society, we are always a failure. Society is always telling, oh, otherwise society will boost you up, and that is also an artificial thing. So therefore the Buddha asked us to go to the forest and sit under a tree, or go to a solitude place. What does it mean by solitude place? The people are not concerned about the sensuous and sexual part. They are concerned only about spiritual part. There are no cosmetics. There are no the gloss over. There are no facelifting. So for a young child or adolescent like you, that is very, very important. I remember when I was young, I was always selecting a matching colors and appear like a hero in front of girls and in front of my classmates. So we select most popular subjects whereby we can attract others' attention. So I was fairly successful. That means I am fairly misleading the class. I became the monitor. I became prefect one time, and ultimately I sacked from that this thing as a punishment because I am very, very manipulative. Machiavellism. So where you know each and everyone is inferior, each and everyone is happy to be inferior, so therefore you can gain mean advantage of the inferior crop, inferior people. So I had that from the beginning. So when I was doing postgraduate, we had the adult psychology. He gave a questionnaire. I was the highest mark. Then my professor told, be careful about this guy. Wherever he goes, he know how to establish power. Because I know everyone is happy to be inferior. I have nothing to claim superior, but I know I am natural. I have common sense. So therefore people, they don't use common sense because they want to be perfect. So it's a joke for me. I am never perfect. But I know. Not due to mindfulness. That's why I was successful in mindfulness. I am happy to accept that I am just a bumpkin. And I got to meet the complete advantage of the free education. And I was born in the intellectual zone and into an intellectual family. So I was a bumpkin. But I found my theories always successful. But I find that is the most lacking thing in the present-day younger generation. They don't have common sense. They are going to get the common sense from the peer groups. They are going to get the common sense from the prize givings and in the performance. They don't consider themselves as born lucky people. Even you are born lucky, even you are born with no any disability or any kind of thing, you never appreciate it. So therefore, understand you being a mindful child, when you are alone, how does this comparative inferiority, superiority is working? How does when you have become socialized among the non-people and the new society? New society means you are creating societies or functions, we call. You are creating functions for us to show our clothing, our performance and our social status. So that is the way present day society is completely satanic. Completely satanic. But a non-person, wherever you go, you have your own intrinsic qualities. So if you are ready to show these intrinsic qualities, everyone will appreciate it. Everyone will accept it rather than this facelifting, rather than this boosting. So younger generation, when I'm traveling in, I have intimate relationship with the Australian families, migrants, and the American families, migrants, I see how this cultural shock, cultural difference is affecting the younger generation. I hesitate to say it is more in the female than males, but the males also subject to situation. So therefore, I think the parents are in utterly desperate situation because they have to completely support the child. They are in adolescence, they have to give the support, but they know it is wrong way because they are living in a different culture. So I can't think about a born Italian in Italy or born French in the France because I have basic understanding. So I'm very happy to share the migrants and the born people with the so-called first world countries and the third world countries. How does it affect to the younger generation? So you must be lucky because that you have some society to express yourself. You have a neutral society to express yourself, not to the peer groups. And you can write this as an interview report. I really appreciate it. I doubt whether I have given any answer. I am just verbalizing my idea. So you have any idea about? Welcome, Buddha Rakita from Malaysia.
Yeah. I think it's really amazing and remarkable that while you were looking in the mirror, that you could notice these things and notice your own thoughts in your own mind about how you looked, and your all your thoughts about what to wear and the perfectionism, and then you know that you could go to the party, to the function, and then also be aware of this dynamic between yourself and others and self, around, you know, this social comparison. And this is like one of the great powers of mindfulness from my point of view, is because we know our own reality, we know what we're thinking, we know what we're feeling. And this is the food, the data or the information that we need to allow wisdom to feed on, so that it can know things as they really are. So perfectionism is seeking a goal, an ideal, a perfection, whereas wisdom is knowing things as they really are. And there was a Japanese company. It had a slogan which was something like, you know, that they sought to be perfect. And then they realized over time that once they made a perfect product, nobody wanted to work on it any further. And if any defects arose in that product, as naturally happens, the engineers resented, you know, that their perfect thing was being criticized. So the company changed the slogan to almost perfect.
Near perfect.
Near perfect or almost perfect, something like this. And so this allowed, gave permission to the engineers to constantly improve and develop their products so that they didn't become a museum piece and they became something really useful and functional in society for people. So this idea of almost perfection is a more practical and useful idea than absolute perfection, because you will die on that sword very painfully. And you know, as Mahatero mentioned, the problem for anybody who is, we'll just say, Sri Lankan, ethnically Sri Lankan, born in Australia, for instance, is that you have this complex issue that your parents were not born into that society. They were born here in Sri Lanka. And you have to navigate both worlds. You have to navigate the expectations of, you know, migrant Sri Lankan parents, a lot of pressure around education and that you be successful and so forth. And then just being an Australian and growing up in Australia, for instance, or America, it doesn't matter which area you were in, but that you're growing up in a completely different environment to your parents. And you understand that society has different expectations, a different model. And so this clash between the model of the reality of the world that you grow up in and your peers and the model and reality of your parents is also going to create a lot of friction for you in your own mind, because you have a reality of where you live and then you have a different kind of reality of where your parents grew up. And so this is a very complicated problem for you to solve. And if you can solve it, it gives you a superpower, because you have insights into your own culture of Australia and your family culture of Sri Lanka. And then you also understand that other migrants have the same issues. And even just people within the same culture can move to a different location, a different country, a different social class. And they have to navigate and change and understand the different dynamics of that particular milieu. So what you're learning is the kind of growing pains of a very, very difficult act that only wisdom itself can solve. And only by being very mindful, as you have been, with regarding yourself in the mirror. And as the Buddha asked his own son, you know, what is the function of a mirror? It is for reflection. And so when you looked at your physical reflection, you had a mental reflection on your mental states. And these difficult mental states, like social comparison, like perfectionism and so forth, are all mental states. They don't appear in the normal mirror. It's only somebody who has a mindful mirror that they can see the reflection of their mind. And then with patience and some right ideas, some right view, and you're asking people about it, so that's very good, that you can actually grow and cultivate a wise solution to your own problem. But if you can do this, then you will be the wiser, and that will be a great achievement.
The same thing happened when you are coming to the mindfulness also, just like going to Australia, just like going to America. You are getting another kind of reflection. So we are going to the next report.
Yes, Bante. I'm Niranja here, Bante. Sorry,
Niranja,
I just
forgot your name.
Yes, Bante. Second report, Bante. Senya, 5 years from Rockhampton Satipasala. Mindful walking. In mindful walking, I walked on the tile floor. I felt tiles were warm because I was wearing socks. I was able to count up to 100. Mindful sitting. In my sitting, I couldn't do it as I got distracted. I heard my dad listening to some Dhamma talk. Mindful game. In the mindful game, there was a person talking and we got 3 answers to choose. In the first one, I didn't choose the answer. In the second time, I was able to find the answer. Teruvan Saranai Banti. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. End of the report.
At the age of 5, you can write something is a miracle. Because my age 5, I was not aware about letters. At the age 6 only, almost at the 6 only we went to the school and like that. And writing completely different from the sitting, walking and day to day is such an organized essay. So therefore, we all generation are happy about you younger people, 5 years old, and can write and send it to another country, another person, and sharing with. It's almost like communicating with the planet Saturn. So therefore, please continue to report like that. And if you wish to add one more sentence, walking, I was doing it, the tiles, and I was counting up to 100. And one another sentence about sitting. Father is listening to Dhamma talk. It is utterly disturbing. Never mind. Are you aware whether you are not walking or you are just sitting? And in the day-to-day, the mindful activity, in the second time, you come across the answer. First time, you understood, I was not aware of the answer. Second time, you are aware, you are not in the first time, but in the second time. So send at one more sentence, that will give the sap. That will give the essence further. Really appreciate your report. We are moving forward.
Second one, Ranu, 10 years old, mindful walking. I worked indoors. I had no distractions. I looked 1.8 meters ahead of me. I had no distractions. I focused on the lower part of my body. I felt the hard tiles. I had no pains. I kept my hands behind my back. Mindful sitting. I sat down in my full lotus posture. I had no distractions. I focused on the upper part of my body. I felt my breath going in and out. I had my eyes closed nearly the whole time. That's the end of the report, Bhante.
Good. So today we are getting reports from the younger generation. And no distraction, you mentioned at least 2 times. That's a blessing. Many people, when there are no distraction, they say it is boring. It's monotonous, not eventful, not dramatic. They never recognize there's a lack of distraction, because we have such a sadistic search for distractions. When there are no distractions, you feel sleepy. You feel monotonous. You feel slimy. And if you know it is no distraction, we call the frictionless path or critical path. So whenever such a thing happens, consider this is your intrinsic nature. This is you are at home. At home, no friction. At home, no distraction. But we don't appreciate it. We always appreciate the friction and the comparison and measuring. So whatever the measure, it's a distraction. So therefore, your two sentences I heard, if I am correct. So I hope you will end up your report also with all the meditation, but no distraction. But don't make it as a boredom. Don't make it a point to be the monotony or boredom. But I am not complaining you, because you are clearly indicated no distraction. Hardly any elderly people write that sentence. They're always talking about the distraction. They're always talking about the problems, because they are always give highlights to the problems. You have given 2 times, no distraction. I really appreciate it. We are moving to the last.
Yes, Bhante. Sydney, 6 years old, from Rockhampton Satipasala. I walked on the tile floor. I felt coldness to my feet. I lifted one leg at a time and placed it on the ground. I repeat and repeat and repeat all over again until the session ended. The coldness feeling didn't change. Mindful sitting. I sat on the couch and left my leg out. I kept one hand on the other and gently closed my eyes. I listened to the bell and it sounded like ding. I listened until the sound ended. Then I focused on my breath cycles. In-breaths were cold and out-breaths were warmer than the in-breaths. In the middle of the session, in-breaths became a bit warmer and the out-breaths became more warmer too. At the end of the session, in-breaths became more warmer and the out-breaths became even more warmer. I felt sleepy at the end, but I did not let my mindfulness go down. I felt amazing. General mindfulness. I ate a green apple mindfully. When I had the first bite, I felt sour taste. It was hard to bite. Inside the apple was white color. I heard the crunchy sounds when I ate it. It is a bit similar to cornflake sound. It was fun. Sadhu, 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 Bante. End of the report.
I apologize because last Sunday I was in Nathagani. I was with prefects, children of the school with the prefects, and I was working with them. And we had two hikings in the rocks. And therefore, after a while only, Thammasanna Hamdro mentioned today is a Rockhampton day. But sorry, I had no chance to even inform you what is happening. So I am also was happy because I was just climbing. And we were making rock carvings. We were making the caves. It was no purpose as such. But we were fully engaged. And I was feverish. I was a little sick. But even then, very happy with the so Sidmi, your report is very comprehensive among the all the children. And it is giving very descriptive coloration. And I was thinking that you are still age 5, but you passed the birthday, now you are age 6. So that you can explain now the mental situation also. Not the physical situation, the everything appear equal. Everything appear, whatever you do, appear equal. And how the mind responds to the apple and the color and the sounds, very descriptive, very happy to listen. And I hope you are not disturbing your Akka and others, because otherwise you are very naughty, shouting. But when you are mindful, I think definitely others will be more mindful by looking at Sidmi. So just pass my response to Sidmi. Thank you for your presentation. Okay, now I would invite Venerable Buddha Rakhita to introduce the new subject, new sutta.
So this is, we're moving on to a new sutta. It's entitled Quarrels and Disputes. How do I pronounce this, Bhante? The
Kalaha Vivada.
Kalaha Vivada Sutta. So this is another sutta in this series in which the Buddha is teaching the devas. And in order to have a very, very deep, profound, subtle conversation with the devas, I mean, the devas are very, very bright, very clever, very capable bunch of people, but they're in a very good position in the world. So there's also a kind of a lack of, you know, they're in a good place, so they don't really see why they should improve anything. So the Buddha forms an image of himself, a different Buddha, like a copy of himself. And this other Buddha is asking questions. So this copy of the Buddha is asking the original Buddha questions, and the original Buddha is answering these questions. And the idea is to create a very deep, subtle kind of conversation for the benefit of the devas, because, you know, they may not necessarily ask these kind of questions because they're actually in a very comfortable world, a comfortable place in karma. So they're quite happy, they're quite content. Whereas the Buddha needs to show them that there is a problem. And so here we begin with the question being asked by this psychically formed Buddha. From where do quarrels and disputes arise? Lamentation, sorrow, and miserliness. From where do conceit and arrogance arise along with slander? Please tell me this. So then I'll just go on to the Buddha Buddha answers. Quarrels and disputes arise from what is pleasing, as do lamentation, sorrow, and miserliness. Conceit and arrogance along with slander. Quarrels and disputes are connected with miserliness and slander. Occur and slanders occur when disputes arise. So here we see a very important sort of skill that many of us would do well to remember, which is when somebody asks us a question, we should remember try to remember the points that we are being asked and then address these points. So the Buddha is sort of clarifying the question, or he's showing that he has heard or listened to the question being posed when he repeats back what the questioner has asked. So this is firstly a very important acknowledgement of a question, that we try to make sure that we are clear and understand what the questioner has asked us. And then the rest of the sutta is where the Buddha will systematically go through each point. So firstly, we should note that there's eight different parts to the question. So those are like quarrels, disputes, lamentation, sorrow and miserliness, conceit, arrogance and slander. So the Buddha is going to go through these eight different points in the rest of the rest of this sutta. So this is the basic structure of this sutta, and maybe I'll listen to what Mahathera has to say about the sutta at this point in time.
Yeah, I can remember the first kuto pahuta kalahavivada. I can't remember the balance in by heart. So that means we don't know how much we are appreciating kalahavivada, how much we are appreciating disputes and quarrels. Otherwise, no go. Life means quarreling. Life means the disputes. That is, we call in the picture, we call very dramatic, very fightful, very, what do you call, action-packed. So our life also, like a film, it must be action-packed. Otherwise, no one will look at. Exactly when we are meditating or when we are living in a normal day-to-day life, if it is not eventful, no history, nothing to remember. We just become very dull. So therefore, we are always promoting this coloration and dramatic part, and that is how the advanced societies and so-called rich people, they have this kind of performance and drama, ballet dance and classic music, all the kind of thing to make some kind of a, in a sense, it's a quarreling. Because a piece is never appreciated because it's very monotonous. So therefore you can understand culture, the civilization and the human society is just a quarreling. Whenever you are living in a society, it is a fight, it is a quarreling, and ultimately the lamentation, sorrow and miserliness. And then people wanted to go to the court and put a complaint, and then fighting, then only the third party has to come. But their initiative, energy, is to have kuto pahuta kalavivada. Always at least we have a debate, maybe very decent one. And the competitions. And that's how they say wild dogs are always fighting each other whenever they get free time. And you can see young monkeys always fighting each other, and puppies always fighting each other. That is their nature. And we really appreciate if the puppies are not fighting, they are not good. If the monkeys are not fighting, they are not good. They are not living. So ultimately it is leading to transgressional level, it is leading to the thread pass level, and then only the third party has to come and say, you are correct, you are wrong. So therefore, from where does this the unsettled situation, excited situation, how it comes, and how much cultural, how much civilized to have this kind of the competition, this kind of fight each other, and how much it is stirring you, catalyzing you, you don't know. And I am born in a big family. I am the quarrel maker at home as well as in the class. So I became the monitor. I became a prefect. But that is an easy way to calm down me, give the leadership.
So then I caught up red-handed, and then next day I was kicked out from prefectship. And the letter is going along the each class, such a person, my name was there, no more a prefect in our school. And that is the worst punishment one can give. So everyone was shocked, sometimes a little bit with me. My physics teacher, very, very calm, and a small figure. Still, I am the monitor, so after the lecture, period, I have to bring a book, and she has to write note, this is the topic we finished, and like that, so I am keeping the boy. So she was waiting without signing, it let everyone go out of the lab. That's what happened. Then I told, this is what happened. I know it will be a very big shock for you to advanced level classes, so therefore I let you know one thing. Still with this kind of a thing, if you can get through, you will be historically first person going to the university. I see you have that capacity. So why don't you take it seriously? And forget about all this kind of prefectship and kind of thing. And it was reverberating in my mind. All the others were looking at me, how I take the shock. And of course, I was the first to go to the science faculty. The classmate also went to the medical faculty for our history in the school. And there, the Vinay teacher came and told that such that guy, he was doing all the kind of troubles, but ultimately he went to the university also. So therefore, this Kalavivad has kind of a dynamism. It was also some kind of a motivation. So Buddha is working with Angulimala and Nalagiri, as well as the Yakkas and all the kind of thing. They are really arrogant people, but they have a spark. And it is not been really recognized in a proper way, and if it is recognized, they will get double promotion. Ultimately, the Buddha gave the convocation. He was the Mahesakya Maharathan. It's the most highest Maharath. Is the Angulimala. Because even the wild elephants are frightening. That is the way. So therefore, not to kick them off and outcast them, but to understand from where does the Kalavivada start, that stirring power. And the catalytic power, often if it is not recognized, gone in the wrong way. If it's caught up in the wrong hands, definitely it will be brutal. But they are the people really can make a turning point in their life as well as in the society. So therefore it's a very good, and there are very serious analysis in the Kalavivada Sutta. The Nasanya Sanyi, Nopya Sanyi, Vibhuta Sanyi, Evan Samitasa Vibhuti Rupan, Sanya Nidanani Papancha Sanya, Sankha. It's a very deepest way of understanding about your mental proliferation. So those who are promoting mental proliferation, promoting the quarrels and the disputes, but if you can turn it in a healthy way, you will get double promotion. So therefore, it is up to the teacher, it is up to the Buddha to provoke that kind of question and to give answer, not always negative, but there's a skill in making it positive. So go more than analyzing it. We'll go by stanza. Please proceed, Bhante.
Sorry, I'll just mention a few more things about this initial verse. The Buddha sort of splits it into four and four, he splits it into groups: quarrels and disputes, lamentation, sorrow, and miserliness. So these are kind of like the dark emotions. These are the declining emotions, meaning you see something you don't like, and you pull away from it, or you're more like pulling away from the object. So you have lamentation, sorrow, and miserliness. So these are kinds of emotions associated with loss or sadness, or sadness and loss. So in this case, like you experience a deprivation. You experience that you're a loser in this situation. So you experience these feelings of lamentation or sadness. You experience sorrow, again, this is kind of sadness, and miserliness. So this is, again, a sense of not having enough. And these emotions are very related to shame, you know, who I am. So I am of this status, this kind of level, but now I'm losing. So then I feel sadness. So sadness, when it arises, lamentation, sorrow, and that feeling of miserliness. I can't afford to give this. I need to hold on to this. This scarcity, this is a kind of a scarce thinking in the mind. These are informing us that shame is arising, like our model of the world. And when I meet this other person, I feel less than, and that I don't have enough. And I can't afford this. I can't share this. And I'm a loser. And this feeling of sadness. So the Buddha is highlighting this kind of mechanism in the mind. And as a result, we have quarrels and disputes. So quarrels and disputes have kind of a slightly different meaning here. Quarrel is you have a fight, whereas dispute is that you're arguing. So these quarrels start after the dispute has happened. So usually people are arguing in their mind or in their mouth verbally. And then from that dispute arises this quarrel. The quarrel is more verbal, and then the dispute is the more physical aspect of the conflict. So, but the underlying mechanism of this quarrel and dispute is this kind of social comparison again. I'm comparing myself to others, and I feel like a loser. I feel loss, and I feel like I can't afford this. I'm in scarcity. Whereas the other is I have a social comparison. This is conceit and arrogance along with slander. So in that is another shame-based kind of thinking. I am greater than. You know who I am. So this arrogance is like I'm better than you. And slander is I'm putting you down. So again, of course, this is not true. So I am not superior, I am not equal to, I am not inferior to, or this is this kind of thinking in shame. Whereas the reality is once one becomes really enlightened, one is this is unique, this is individual, you know. So this the crux, the base of this set of questions is asking really about conceitedness, this ego and shame. So once ego exists, social comparison exists. Once social comparison exists, there's a judgment, and with that judgment comes a sense of shame, and that shame will manifest as I am superior to, I am equal to, or we're all the same, or I am inferior. And with that, then all this host of other feelings will arise. Like, if I feel inferior to somebody else, then I will feel lamentation, sorrow, and miserliness. Whereas if I feel superior to somebody else, then I will feel conceit and arrogance. And then we get the verbal sides of it, like the physical and verbal sides of quarreling and disputing, or we get the slandering and putting down of other people. So if we see these emotions in our own mind, we can take care of them in an appropriate, wise, and skillful way, like we were mentioning earlier on to our 17-year-old going to the function. You know, the purpose of the mirror is reflection. And we have physical reflection. You know, we can see the physical mirror, seeing the physical body. And then with mindfulness, we have this mental mirror where we know and understand and see these states of mind arising, like lamentation, sorrow, and miserliness, or conceit and arrogance. And behind that is this social judgment, this shame that I am inferior or I am superior. And with that arises these quarreling and disputes or slandering and, you know, this bickering. A lot of it is coming back to this social judgment. But we can continue if you wish. Do you have anything further to say?
In comparison with this, the God-created society has the ancestral guilt. Ancestral guilt is something you are born with. Because the Eva done the criminal thing and Adam, and then the God chase you away from the paradise. So this is your own dispute and your own quarrels and all the kind of thing. And therefore, the Godwin was, when he was talking about, he told that guilt has no single translation. We don't have an equivalent in single language, because these things we have, because this is my own creation, at least my ignorance. But other people say it can't help because it's ancestral guilt. Our early ancestors, they committed some crimes, so God is wrath is us. So they find it is none of our business, but we have to suffer. But here it is my own business, I have to suffer. So these two dimensions is very rare meet together. Those who have ancestral guilt, they never consider this as my own responsibilities. And those who are with this, they are hesitant to accept it is as a, it's a mistake. It says it's a way of life. It's a dramatic way of life. We are dynamic. And then disputes and everything happens. So therefore source, it's internal or external. But ultimately it is, but the Buddhist's point of view, we can say it is attributable to the ignorance as well as the desire. But the ancestral guilt, it's a bunch of everything, and this is not belongs to us. It is endowed with. So that's all I would like to share in this moment.
Let's go on and let's listen to what the Buddha actually has to say about each of these points. So I'll begin with the third verse in this, the third one. No, the third, because I already mentioned his reply. He's, you know. So from what do pleasing things in the world originate? And those states of greed that spread through the world, from what do longing and fulfillment originate, which a person has about the future? So, sorry, again, this is the second set of questions by the psychic Buddha to the original Buddha. So again, you see, the Buddha very skillfully answers, exactly repeating back the question. Pleasing things in the world originate from desire, as do those states of greed that spread through the world. From this originate the longing and fulfillment that a person has about the future. So, again, this is something very interesting how the Buddha, he answers from within the question. So he's very carefully listening to the question, and it kind of shows the value in information, in fact, that the better the question, the better the answer can be. And that a lot of life is not about finding the question, finding the answer, but actually formulating a very good question. With a good question comes the good answers. And So a lot of people think, oh, I'm stupid because I ask questions, and this person is very clever because they can give the answer. But the reality is that a well-formulated question is far more clever than the answer, because the answer becomes almost like a self-revelation itself. And very often I find in conversations with people, and they come and they ask, how can we solve this, how can we solve that? That if I listen very carefully, then usually they have the answer themselves within their question. If they're kind of thoughtful, and if they've kind of, you know, they've already pulled together all of the different components of the problem into the question, so that usually it's just helping them to remove, you know, to move around their own question as a kind of an answer. So this is what the Buddha is doing here, that the psychic version of the Buddha is formulating, presenting tremendous questions to the Buddha, and the Buddha answers from within the question itself, the answer. And this is for the benefit of those people who are listening, And there are so many things to learn from this kind of way that the Buddha is questioning and answering. And we should not view the answer as more important than the question to some degree. It's the question is the real genius to some degree here.
So that I read some analysis of Nagarjuna, Mulada Madhyama Karika, and they are the later criticism came when you have a dialogue. There are two types, Prasangika and Swatantra. Prasangika means you analyze and say what you said first is not related to the last, is not tallying. So that kind of a dispute in your question itself is presented. And that is what we sometimes do in listening to the interview reports. And the Swatantra is, you just give your own ready-made answer, homemade answer, you give it to the listener, the questioning people. So Prasangika is, you are analyzing the question and say your answer is within the question. Or question is not well formed. So therefore, many people who criticize Nagarjuna, they say he did Prasangika. He did only analyze and say the Advaita Vedanta is wrong by itself. Instead, he never mentioned what is the remedy. Remedy is what the Buddha mentioned already. So therefore, he has nothing to add, no Swatantra. So ultimately, that was not much accepted. Many people wanted to have ready-made answer to the question. So Isaac, if I am correct, that Einstein, what he did was, he asked to read the question first in the maths. Answer is there. You have to apply the theory and formulas and kind of thing, but the answer is within. When people think, no, answer you have to find. No, answer is within. That is called prasangika. Prasangika means your analytical way, very dynamic. And if you read the book Saints and Psychopaths by Bill Hamilton, he says there's one master I found on the earth while I'm traveling. He give the answer from your question, exactly the same wordings he use, and he think he sees at least anagami. At the anagami level, not only you can understand the question, otherwise you get excited by the question. So that prasangika thing, we have nothing to do because Buddha has given the universal answer. We have to find your question is not grammatical, not in a formalized in a proper way. By analyzing that, it appear like you are adding nothing. You just analyze this, you are prasangika.
Actually, Godwin was very good at this too, and he would ask us questions like we would discuss and read the Majjhima Nikaya, and everybody would give their opinion, and then in the end he would sum up what everybody else had said, but it was absolutely clarifying and
he's
clear and lucid, and in a way he wasn't there either. You know, it had that kind of quality that he was very modest, and he was acknowledging everybody else in the room, and it all became very clear after he had said it, but it seemed like everybody had contributed to the answer, and it was really astonishing, actually. Yeah.
At last he said this, everything is in that particular sutta, and that gives the answer. He has said nothing. He did only summarize and say, please read, refer to that. You see, he knows A to Z.
It's very funny because I think this quality of Godwin used to annoy the hell out of Dhammajiva, because he used to call him a sneaky vegetable.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't put your finger on him that he had said anything, because it seemed like he hadn't said anything. It was everybody else had said it. And this was very sneaky to Dhammajiva and very annoying.
I annoyed Godwin two times.
You annoyed him two times?
Yeah. So he was got up and went there. Because I know any saint I can stir. Even Upandita Sayadu, even Jnanarama. I can stir them because I know my way of analyzing is, I am critical to upon him. He's a very master, he's superior. But I can find some faults. And immediately I show it, he got up and went there. Because he was mastering a lay meditation center in Nilambe. I asked, when Godwin was not there, I asked, what the hell lay meditation center? It must be a meditation center. Because monks are not allowed.
And on the way back, Godwin coming, we changed the signboard. And Godwin asked, who did it? I told, I did it. It's better if you have not done that kind of a thing. He get up and went there. Because I just wanted to have break the board of directors. And what the lay meditation center? So Godwin was not happy because they are very benevolent board of directors, not to disturb them. He was not disturbed, but I disturbed. So that is the way, kind of, I can annoy Godwin, even Godwin. No harm. Even I can annoy even the Buddha Rakita. No harm.
So coming back to this second group, from what do pleasing things in the world originate? The answer the Buddha gives, pleasing things in the world originate from desire. So this is the reverse of the First Noble Truth. From what do suffering things in the world originate? We'll say suffering things in the world originate from tanha. You know, from this is the first and second noble truth coming together. So there's two sides to the second noble truth. One is that there is suffering, and the other is to say that there is desire or pleasurable things. So we should understand it's actually the same reference to the first and second noble truth here. So again, some of the Burmese and some of the commentators, they always play this game of spot the noble truths in any discussion by the Buddha. So again, like you, if you take the four noble truths as a guiding principle, you can almost look at almost every sutta and find them. You know, so the Buddha has this unbelievable skill at weaving the noble truths into almost any discussion about anything. You know, you kind of have to see it. Sometimes it's like the positive side. He'll say, in this case, desire, and the flip side is suffering. So the two come together, and this is something you have to get used to. This is the paradox that only wisdom can see, that with suffering is desire, with desire, suffering. You know, and it's just a reality. It's not something you can logically figure out. You have to just observe this to be true or false in the world. And those states of greed that spread through the world, as do those states of greed spread through the world. From this originates the longing and fulfillment. What do longing and fulfillment originate? From what do longing and fulfillment originate? Which a person has about the future. From this originates the longing and fulfillment that a person has about the future. So here, longing and fulfillment are being related back to desire. So when we have desire, we have longing and fulfillment. So when we have desire, we have suffering. That's what he's saying here. So this is like the first and second noble truth being put into one verse. And he's just asking a question that he's going to answer, and he's answering it in this formula of the first and second noble truth, and he's just switching it from desire, from suffering to desire, desire to suffering, and linking the two back and forth. So this is actually how one investigates things in one's own mind for wisdom. You have to establish the object. So the object is that the mind is bending towards the object. So that is desire happening. And so why is that desire? This inquiring mind is setting up. It's not just a question. It's an inquiry. And the mind is looking at it back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Desire is suffering. Suffering is desire. Longing and fulfillment, desire, suffering, desire, suffering. And the mind has to flick it back and forth millions and millions of times until it eventually kind of wisdom penetrates. It isn't just normally desire is bending towards the object, aversion is bending away from the object, whereas wisdom penetrates the object. It penetrates it and it sees absolutely clearly for itself. You know, it's yata bhuta dasana. It is tracing it back to the cause. It is yoni soma manasikara. It is all of these qualities of wisdom. Wisdom suddenly goes pow right through the middle of the heart of it, and it penetrates it. So these verses are not just like cute synopsis of great theory and great insight. These are actually the inquiries that the mind needs to set up. These apparent contradictions. Like, how can desire be suffering and suffering desire? How can longing and fulfillment be like this twisted twin that flick back and forth. And only wisdom can penetrate this kind of paradoxical question. And so this is very, very profound. This is the first and second noble truths in action right here. And it's not a cute little verse. He's saying exactly how you contemplate this. These are meditation instructions. This is contemplation. This can only be resolved breathing in, breathing out, desire breathing in, suffering breathing out, desire breathing in, suffering, and this setting up the right attitude, the right question, the right mindfulness, the right livelihood, the right whole Eightfold Noble Path is the only thing that can penetrate this. You can go to 10,000 lectures from the greatest minds in the world and none of this will crack it for you. You have to directly know this for yourself in your mind with wisdom and holding it with the chopsticks of sati and samadhi.
Yeah, just before that we had the concept and reality from Vedmanyanananda's. We did discuss in Singhala. It says that once this is penetrated, you are no more. The argument is no more. The person is no more. He is already enlightened. So therefore, whenever you put into words, it is not perfect. It is not eternal. So whenever this happens, the person is completely understanding or realizing. So therefore, it says, Pachyuda Vattanti, when you hit a ball, rubber ball against the rock, it will bump out. Just like if you are going to go with the linear system, if you are going to go with the wordings and grammar, you will never. Once it happens, you are no more. You are a different person, and there is a turning point. So that is why he quoted from the Udanapali, and sometimes from here, these words, Buddha express them in the words. But it says, if it is really happening, there won't be any continuation of yourself. Self will be dissolved, as you mentioned. It has to do in 1,000 times. Sometimes you get lost again, re-establish again. So vijnana, namarupa, they are reciprocal each other. Whenever the vijnana is there, vijnana is preparing a namarupa. And earlier I thought, within the nama, vijnana is involved. Very philosophically it says, in the namarupa, vijnana is not there. Vijnana, namarupa is a creation of the vijnana. So therefore, vijnana cannot create vijnana. So therefore, in the namarupa, in the nama, vijnana is not available. So that kind of a thing is paradoxical. And only these things are explained in the Udanapali and the Sutta Nipata, and very difficult to teach in a classroom. In a Buddhist philosophy or Buddhist culture. So therefore, one has to have this rational knowledge as well as the meditative experience. But even then, it has to happen in 1,001 times. Appear like going forth and coming back, going forth and coming back. That's the point where the patience and the equanimity must be there.
But also the sati and the samadhi to hold the object. You have to kind of hold, like I said, they're chopsticks. Like people make a big thing, like I'm a samatha practitioner, I'm a vipassana practitioner. Like this is like trying to eat food with one chopstick. You know, you're just skewering it and poking it and messing with it. You need the two. You need the two together, and you can't say one is more than the other. They have different functions, they have different characteristics, and yada yada. Just like, again, if you know anything about holding chopsticks, one is firm and one is moving. Just like your mouth. The upper jaw is firm and the lower jaw is up and down, chattering away, you see? So we think, oh yeah, both jaws are the same. No, one is not moving, the other one is moving. So one is like samatha, one is like vipassana. The vipassana is more moving, the samatha is more rigid, stiff. But you need the two acting and working together to bite. And the function is to cultivate the wisdom. And the food is like this dilemma between suffering, desire, suffering, desire, suffering, desire. And, you know, to hold the object is very difficult because normally we're scattering off of the object because of too much effort, sort of hatefulness, On the other hand, we're a bit lazy, we're a bit dull, we're topper, we don't reach the object. So to actually hold it is like more delicate than holding a champagne glass or something incredibly fragile. You're holding it, and if you can't squeeze it, it'll shatter. You know, if you don't hold it well enough, you'll drop it, and all the time just trying to hold it there in a graceful way for wisdom to arise, and that takes this like thousands and thousands of raindrops that eventually the dam overflows, and just that's the breakthrough. And it seems like mundane. You're doing the same silly thing every single day, but that's gathering the raindrops behind the dam. And that takes quite a lot of patience and insight. You know, somebody was driving me back to the airport, and they were saying, I understand fear. You know, I didn't understand fear. And, you know, I was afraid of death, and now I'm not afraid of death. And I was like, I'm not sure about that. You know what I mean? Like I said, I think you need to give it a little bit more time and don't be surprised with all the manifestations of fear and how they can evolve. And fear of death, and that is a big, big fear to overcome. I said, this is an anagami. An anagami has solved fear. You know, if you think you've solved fear, then you're an anagami. And that's a great achievement. Even a soan, a sotapanna, is a great achievement. That is where the water has gone over the dam, the first weir. And that's the great, great achievement. So to be an anagami is like, come on. That's the Three Rivers Gorges. You know, this is a huge dam.
That part is well explained in Sabbasava Sutta. All the yogis have one of the six wrong views. Beforehand, they say, I am a being, or I am not a being. Or they say, as a being, I am trying to be not self, self. And being not self, trying to be self. That kind of a six shades, very difficult to understand. That is a kind of a disease or mental situation only affected to the meditators, or only affected with the virtuous people. That going to virtues means you are falling into the trap of one or the other ditthi traps. And in a discussion, we can pinpoint. You are talking with that nihilistic idea, you are talking with the eternalism, or you are going to from nihilism to nihilism, nihilism to eternalism. All the jargon, only six. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and this person was just so, they had this righteous conceit. It was just such, you know, you could feel it on your tongue. It was that kind of bitter and cut. It was just so righteous. And if that is there, you know that the person hasn't resolved fear, because anger is like the counterparty of fear. Like anger is I will strike it, whereas fear is I will shrink away from it. And that's like the model we're talking about here. Sorrow and limitation and miserliness is shrinking away, whereas the conceit and arrogance is pushing forward. And it's just two sides of the same coin, you know. And like, I'm not saying it to criticize this person, but it's the tragedy. It's really tragic. And again, coming back to one of the discussions Godwin used to have, and he was talking about meeting a forest monk and asking what was his perspective on life. And he said, well, you know, it's funny, sometimes tragic comedy, but nevertheless funny. And wisdom has this, like, it's funny. Once you penetrate through, you realize, oh my gosh, what a tragic comedy, funny thing that is. That wisdom, the desire is the counterpart to aversion. Just back forth. Oh my gosh, what a tragedy! How funny, and it's just woof.
And very aesthetic.
Yeah,
that is the way aesthetic comes.
It's a cosmic joke.
Yeah. So we are going to stop it because almost time up for the Pindapatha. Hope others have no any comments to do. So thank you very much for the participation, and we will be moving further in the next Tuesday.